Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week I'm live at OSCON. I'm going to be talking about OpenHub, a place where you can find out all sorts of data about all your favorite open source projects. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz, episode 433, recorded May 9th, 2017, OpenHub. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price, because everyone deserves a great night's sleep. Get $50 off any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/floss and enter the promo code FLOSS. And by Cloudflare. More than 6 million websites, apps, APIs, and SaaS companies use Cloudflare services to weather whatever the internet throws at them. For a free online chat session with a Cloudflare support engineer, visit cloudflare.com/twit. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, Libre, open source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at StoneEdge.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, the little projects, projects you may be using every day and not aware of it, projects you might want to download or play with right after this show. This week, you might notice a slightly different background from any of the recent ones you might have seen. We're actually live at OSCON. I've been attending OSCON now here for, well, this is the second day here, and been running around attending sessions as much as I can and meeting up with old friends and making new friends and all sorts of wonderful things. The bandwidth here is a bit challenged, so you might occasionally hear a bad audio dropout or anything, and also we're technically challenged because I have an entire portable studio set up here with my own mics and everything. Usually when I do it by myself, I've just got one headset, one microphone, but this time I am all of it. It's all going to be me. So if you see a few switcher switches, don't blame the guys up in Petaluma. It's all my fault. Also, I'm in Austin, Texas. It's been sunny and hot the last couple of days. However, I needed to run over and get a part right at the last minute here back to my hotel, and it was raining. So if my hair looks a little wet, it's because I was out there in the drizzle taking care of myself in the rain that's there. Today we have an interesting project, been around for a long time, called OpenHub. We have the engineering manager and the team leader at Black Duck for OpenHub, Peter Dagan Portnoy, who's going to be speaking to us in a few minutes about it. And basically what it is a way for you to investigate and research and see how active all these wonderful, I think something like 15,000 open source projects that it tracks are in there. I'm sure people will give me a better number if that's not quite right. And it's great because I can type in things like Dart, because, you know, I've had a lot of recent interest in Dart. You can type in, you know, my favorite Perl projects like Catalyst. Even my own personal CGI prototype was in there being tracked. So I was pretty happy about that. So even though I haven't made a commit to it in 8 years, and it needs some loving, I tell you, on some of the newer architectures. But it's nice to be able to have a place where you can go and find out, you know, if you're curious, like somebody tells you about an open source project, is this really being used by anybody? Or is it something that is so innovative or abandoned even? Probably the worst is abandonware, people that actually aren't doing anything more on that. I'm sure Peter will have a lot to say about that in a few minutes. But before we do that, we have a special guest joining the show today to talk about something very near and dear to him. Leo, are you out there?
We'll get right back to Floss Weekly in just a second. You know, I remember my good friend, a big nerd ranch, Andrew Hillegas, Aaron Hillegas, in his book of Coco Programming, in the very beginning, he says something I think that I've taken with me over the years as brilliant advice. This is for people going to his class to learn coding. He says, caffeine is no substitute for sleep. Get a good night's sleep. If you want to be on top of the world, you can't drink more coffee. You got to get a good night's sleep. And a good night's sleep is good for everything, for your health in general. I got a great night's sleep last night, and you can too, on my Casper mattress. Love Casper mattresses. Casper, it sells premium mattresses made in the USA, but they sell them direct, which means you save a huge amount of money. There's no mattress store or department store markup. There's a downside to that. It means you can't, you know, go to the mattress store and lie on it to see if you like that mattress. But I got to tell you, lying on a mattress for 5 minutes in a mattress store with the salesperson glowering at you under broad daylight and fluorescent lights is no way to test a mattress. So Casper actually has a better way of doing this. They'll send you the mattress in an amazingly compact box, whether it's twin, queen, king, even California king. You open it up, you put it on your bed, and you sleep on it for up to 100 nights. You can try it not for 5 minutes, but for 100 nights, what, 800 hours. And if at any point in that time you say, you know, I like my old mattress better, no problem. You call them, the courier will come, they'll take it away, they'll refund you every penny. Absolutely no cost to you. But you're not going to say that. I know, because I have a Casper. I've given Caspers to friends, to family. My kids, when they went to college, they got Caspers. Casper is made of supported memory foams for a sleep surface that is perfect. It has sink, just the right sink, but also firm, just the right bounce. It's kind of the best of both worlds. It's breathable design. It sleeps cool. That means as these hot summer months, you know, come, you're gonna be cool. Helps you regulate your temperature, and that's important too to a restful night's sleep. Long lasting comfort, long lasting support. You can buy it online, and it's completely risk free. I want you to check it out. Go to Casper.com right now. They offer free shipping in the U.S. and Canada, and free returns anytime in the first 100 days. Casper.com/floss. In fact, if you use the offer code at Casper.com/floss, if you use the offer code floss, you'll get $50 off towards a mattress purchase. It's already very affordable, but now it's even better. Casper.com/floss. Use the promo code floss. Some terms and conditions apply. A great night's sleep awaits you, my friends, with that great Casper mattress. When it's time for a new mattress, and you should get one, you know, every 5 to 10 years, you should get a new mattress. Get a Casper. Casper.com/floss. And now back to Floss Weekly.
Every time I read this, I want to go get a Casper mattress. I'm going to have to get one of those soon just to actually see what it's like. But let's go ahead and introduce our guest, Peter Dagan-Portney. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Randall.
And normally this is the part of the show where I say, where are you speaking to us from? But I know where it is. You're just 2 feet to my right. So if you hear a little overlap in our mics and stuff like that, again, this is a portable studio. We just do what we can. And I've been doing this a couple of years in a row now, and it seems to work pretty well. So, Peter, why don't you go ahead and describe to us who you are, and did I get Open Hub right?
You did. Essentially, you got it right. You didn't give us quite enough credit for all the work that we do, but we'll fix that.
Go ahead. Tell us more about that.
Sure. The Open Hub is the world's largest repository for freely available analytics on open source software. We generate statistics on commits, contributors, languages, repositories for over 600,000 projects.
Whoa, okay.
We track over 600,000 individual code locations. Our goal is to update those data every 24 to 72 hours. Admittedly, we're having issues right now. We can go into why, which is actually exciting news in terms of our architecture. And we make those data available for free over our website and through an API that makes most of the data available as well. We don't market, we don't spam anybody, we don't sell our lists. This is really Black Duck effort to give back to the open source community.
Well, that sounds really fascinating. You're right. I did undersell it. I said 50. You said 600,000. So I appreciate that. How did this get started?
This was started by the founders. It was Olo.net in 2006. In case you're curious about Olo, my understanding is Olo is a specific size of surfboard. It's not an acronym for anything. It was just a neat word the guys found, and it was acquired by Black Duck in 2010 and has grown significantly over the past few years from about 200,000 projects to over 600,000.
Okay, and so how are people using this data?
Right, that's great. We see all sorts of... Well, so we go out to the internet at large, we get open source repositories, we pull them down, and we walk through all of the commit history. We track every committer, every commit, we do line diffs, we summarize all of that, we draw the trends, we draw the charts. What we find is people come in and they will dig down into individual commits. They're looking through source and looking at the individual contribution that some person made, and they're reading the message, and they're looking at the number of lines and added and code removed. We also have people who are building what we like to call their open source resume. So they'll claim all of their contributions, and we'll generate stats on their languages, on their projects. We'll identify the language in which they work most often. And again, we put all that out there as well.
You know, that is one of the things I saw when I was researching this, actually just early this morning, is I always wait till the last second because I have too much stuff to do, is I actually found my own name. And I was looking at the various commits I've made for things like even the Git project core itself and a bunch of other things, things I had forgotten that I had contributed to. And this seems, wait, what do you say, claim?
I hope you claimed them. I hope you said, these are my commits, because you can find them, and you can claim those contributions, and we'll generate all of those data and make it available. You can have an account for free. Again, we're not going to market to you. And then we'll generate this open source resume for you. We'll tell you when you first made a commit, when your most recent commit was, how many projects you commit to, all of that information.
And how did you get involved with the Black Duck in general, and then also the specific project here?
I started over four and three quarter years ago at Black Duck on the team. It was the Olo team at the time. It's the only Ruby on Rails application at Black Duck, and they had an opening, and I was fortunate to get along well with the team members there at the time, and have grown to Scrum Master and then Engineering Lead and Tech Lead for the team.
So tell me a little bit about what's behind the scenes of this, because I'm sure you mentioned how it's Ruby on Rails,
yes.
So I'm already gristling a little bit, but that's okay. Tell me more about what's behind the scenes on this. How are you crawling? You're crawling GitHub, you're crawling SourceForge, you're crawling all these sites to come up with what you've got. How are you doing this? What's the technology look like?
Sure. We are an open source story from stem to stern. We run on Ubuntu, open source. Our database is Postgres. We use Nginx, we use Passenger, we use Ruby, we use Rails, we use Redis. We use a full open source stack from top to bottom. The code that we've written that to do this is five distinct applications. We call it the Olo stack in deference to our founders.
Sure.
It starts off with the Olo SCM. This is a library that we use to go out to five different types of software configuration management systems.
Mm-hmm.
We support CVS, SVN, Git, Mercurial, and Bazaar.
Okay.
And we fetch repositories using this library and bring it down locally. Then we use a second open source library called OCount to identify the lines of in each file, how many lines were added, how many lines were removed, what was the primary language. OCount identifies, I think, over 108 distinct languages. And so if there's a language that you're not seeing on the Open Hub, we need your pull request on OCount so that we can support it. Then the three applications that we use, we have a back-end system that does fetch, import, and slocking, single line of code counting. We call that our FizzBot, fetch, import, slock bot.
Oh, nice.
And we run a stack of those pretty beefy virtual machines, all writing to a SAN. We've got 16 terabytes of data right now. We expect to triple that by the end of the year, working with our other colleagues at Black Duck. And walk each code location, we walk through all of the history and write it into the database. Every commit, every contributor, every diff, all of that stuff goes in. And then we run a second application, which is our Olo analysis engine, and that cuts through the data multiple times. We're looking for a project can have multiple code locations, so we aggregate all of that information for the project. Mm. Then we'll take all of the projects that an organization like Apache or Mozilla or even Genevi owns, and we aggregate the information for all of the projects and the contributors for the organization. We generate the statistics for the individual contributors, and we make that all available. If you have an account on Olo and you've told us about your open source contributions, we'll aggregate that information for the account and present that as well. And then we provide monthly summaries, and we provide an overview for all of the repository information we have because we have access to multiple forges.
Now, I was researching for today's show, I saw that you had a lot of graphs.
Yes.
And you have a lot of statistics from all those to support all those graphs. And you've been playing with this for 5 years now. What's been your biggest trends that you've seen in open source software? Can you bring it down to like two sentences or two paragraphs?
No, there's too much.
Okay. Well, take as long as you want that.
It's pervasive. First of all, we see it all over the place. Secondly, there's never just one solution. There's all sorts of alternatives. Third, we see that there's so many different people who can contribute to open source. It becomes this ecumenical environment. We ourselves, while we were working on our Olo user interface, the web application, we found that there was a defect in Rails that was impacting us, and one of our team members made a pull request. It was accepted. and our work was in there. That's the spirit of open source. That's what we're seeing from our work. What we would like to be able to do is really help the open source community get credit for the work that they do and discover all of the things that are out there. The 600,000 projects that we have, I think, is a small subset of what's really out there, the data to mine.
And why do you say that?
Well, because I think that people are constantly forking and making small changes and small improvements, and it's difficult to discover those. It's difficult to find those. There's all sorts of organizations that recognize the value of developer happiness by letting them contribute to open source and put their work back out there. And so we think that there are organizations that are producing open source software and publishing it, but without a lot of fanfare. We know from our commercial side that we will go into customer sites and we will scan their code. And even with the 600,000 projects that we have on the Open Hub, which is focused on active software, if we can still get to the repository, we want to keep the project on the Open Hub. But our knowledge base has way more projects than that that are no longer available on the internet at large that we've scanned and stamped and identified, and we can match against those in our commercial product. We know, even with this volume of open source history, there's a large number of open source components we don't know about. We can't match. So we're always in customer sites, and we're seeing, now when I say large, I have to preface this so the sales guys don't beat me up, right?
Okay,
so if we scan a customer client base and we discover 1,200 open source components, but there are six that the customers call that a large gap. That's a large number, even though percentage-wise, it's tiny. That's where I think all of these hidden gems lie. That's where I think that we can really build the open source repository that we have at the Open Hub and let the open source community really come and discover, match, discuss, take credit for the work that they do in building amazing pieces of software.
This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Cloudflare. Cloudflare is on a mission to help build a better internet. Cloudflare makes your site or app faster, safer, and more reliable so you can stop worrying about slow loading page times, downtime, or getting hacked. Cloudflare is easy to use, and sign up takes less than 5 minutes. Cloudflare's global network of 115-plus data centers caches your content and moves it closer to visitors. Their web optimization features speed up your code and make it mobile responsive. End-to-end, Cloudflare speeds up every request to your site with performant DNS, caching, content optimization, load balancing, and more. Cloudflare doesn't only provide DDoS protection. Their web application firewall is powered by a massive IP reputation that updates for all users. Cloudflare's 24/7 security team is constantly watching for new vulnerabilities and deploying real-time protection. No matter what you choose for your cloud compute, AWS, Azure, Google Cloud, a combination of public and hybrid, Cloudflare works with all of them. Using Cloudflare gives your business an option to use more than one cloud provider so you don't get locked into any of them. If you're hit with a DDoS attack or if your site suddenly experiences a surge in legitimate traffic, you pay the same amount. Plans range from free, $20 a month, $200 a month, and custom plans for enterprises. Cloudflare is offering TWIT listeners a free online chat session with one of their top support engineers to answer any of your questions. Visit cloudflare.com/TWIT to sign up today. That's cloudflare.com/TWIT. And we thank Cloudflare for their support of Floss Weekly. And now let's go back with our guest today, Peter. Tell me a little bit more about what the commercial side of your organization is doing and why they would need to scan for all this open source software.
Sure. Great. That's an excellent question. Thank you, Randall. Mm-hmm. Black Duck sells our product called the Black Duck Hub, which is installed in customer sites, scans their local repositories, fingerprints the code that we discover there, and matches it against our massive knowledge base. So there's no personally identifiable information or even corporate identifiable information going back and forth between the two. And we pull back these matches, and we're able to tell the customers how much open source, what specific libraries, what versions they have, what licenses govern those, what vulnerabilities are known about those, so they can manage open source effectively. So they can identify, hey, we've got a component in a sensitive area that needs to be upgraded. And that's the kind of value that we like to bring.
And I get you just brought up vulnerabilities. I did see on some of the pages no known vulnerabilities on this particular piece of software. Are you matching this up with like the CVEs as they come out? And how do you do the matchup of the CVE versus the actual product? This sounds like a massive AI thing. How does it, or is it a lot of hand-picked tables? It can't be all that.
No, you're right. It is a massive automation effort. And we work very closely with MITRE, with the National Vulnerability Database. We have an engineer who participates in those, I think, bi-weekly conversations.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting our data right now mostly from the NVD. We do have some private partnerships. Most importantly, we've spun up an entire research division in Belfast, Ireland, focused 100% on improving our ability to identify and match confidently, reliably, open source vulnerabilities with the components. And as we build out this capability and roll it into our features, we expect some of this will also be able to appear on the Open Hub. And of course, all of the full details will be available in our commercial product. So we're improving the landscape. And we are using AI and we are using natural language processing. And we're looking into machine learning in order to be able to do these matches and to be able to definitively identify this is a real vulnerability that affects specifically these versions and not this version and not this version, so we can report that information accurately to our customers. If you've ever worked with the National Vulnerability Database, you might know that it has a particular labels like, this vulnerability affects all previous versions. What does that mean? Is that everything in the major release? What about the major releases before it? What about a major release from a previous version that came chronologically after the one that we're looking at? This is just, dates are hard, right? Dates are intrinsically difficult. These are the kinds of challenges that we face. We do it in an automated manner. Of the 600,000 projects, we have about 425,000 projects with analyzable source. Of those, there's only vulnerability data in the NVD about 3,200 of them.
Right.
So a tiny fraction. So most of the projects you'll see, there's no known vulnerability data. Just means that nobody has reported anything yet. That's the best that anybody can do, I think.
Can you mention forking earlier? Can you detect when a project forks without anybody telling you?
GitHub will provide that information, and we do use GitHub's APIs for tracking some of that stuff. On the Open Hub, we're a wiki. We allow people to come and create an account. We don't charge them. We don't spam them. We're asking for community support and community activity. We obviously can't go out and discover all of the open source software out there. We need to provide value to the community so they come to our site and tell us what's important, tell us what to watch, and add those projects. Anybody by default can edit any project. Somebody can claim to be a manager for a project and claim ownership of it, and then they can restrict the edits. The vast majority of projects are completely editable by anybody on the site. We do have a number of techniques to watch out for badly behaved players and have very little vandalism or unpleasant activity on the site, so I'm happy about that.
Let's talk about some use cases for this data. Obviously, we've already established it's a massive amount of data with a lot of different derivations, a lot of different designs to it, and a huge amount of just raw data. What can I use this for as an individual contributor?
Sure. One of the things that we find most often is people are coming to the site and they're looking for similar projects, and we show those. We'll show four similar projects on the default page. You can drill down and look at more. We match them up by the tags. Again, we need the community to tell us what's important about this project. And the tags and the description, we use some language processing and text searching to match all of those things up. And you can then compare projects side by side, and you can see the activity. We report the facts, but we also have invented some independent metrics to help summarize and categorize the activity on an open source project. For example, what does it mean if we see that an open source project has had 500 commits in the past 12 months, and we see another open source project has had 50 commits in the past 12 months?
Yeah.
If Project A has 4,000 developers and Project B has 50, these aren't really quite comparable items. One's a very large project, one's a much smaller project. So we took an opinionated position, and we said open source community is more important than just mere contributions, the sheer number of commits. And so we developed a metric that we call the project activity indicator. Mm. It uses an inverse logarithmic slope, and so more recent activity is more important, more so the number of people who are working on it than the number of commits that are made. And as time passes, that activity becomes less and less important. Mm. We roll all of this up and we generate these numbers for all of the projects, and then we split them up into seven categories. And that's a single indicator that we put right on the top of every project page, the project activity indicator, that can tell you in a proportional manner, is this project active? Are there people who are making active contributions on it? And we'll look at that over the past 12 months. So it's a good long view, and anything older than that starts to tail down. But even that's not enough to monitor open source community, because open source is happening right now in every moment. So we invented another indicator, which we call the project hotness score on the projects page, where we're looking at the last few weeks of activity, and we're looking at the ramp, how many contributors are making how many commits day after day after day over the past few weeks. And when there's a lot of activity, that drives up the hotness score. And again, it doesn't matter if it's a Mozilla-sized project or it's a tiny project that's just in incubation, we'll be able to show you there's a lot of activity or not so much. So we're also providing these summary indicators as well as the raw facts.
And is there one thing I get a lot on this show over the 10 years I've been doing it is sometimes there are projects that all the contributors or most of the contributors are in a company, the company that was built around supporting it. And other projects, which I would consider more mature and more community-oriented, would have more variety in their domain names of the contributors. Is that any kind of metric that you have?
Yes, we do. We have a section of the site called organizations, and we support non-commercial and commercial and governmental organizations, and we will create the organization and will allow the organization managers to claim their open source projects that they support. And then we'll aggregate all of that information. We present a graphic summary view of the projects, the number of projects managed by the organization, and the number of affiliated committers. Then the projects those committers support outside of the organization, and as well as people outside of the organization who are contributing to their project. So a full landscape view of the activity inside these open source organizations.
So what else can I glean from looking at one of these projects pages as an individual contributor? Obviously, is it alive or dead? Do I recognize some of the committers? Is there a way to say, I have these friends, and if they're contributing to projects, I want to know about them?
That's a really great idea. You can give them kudos on the site. If you recognize them, you can give them a little high five, and we'll rank them so that when people are searching for open source contributors, we'll push them to the top.
Ooh.
But I like the idea of being able to have that active conversation. We do have forums, and we do allow those kinds of shout-outs on the forums as well.
Okay. We can't get too far into the show without me understanding what the license for the data is. Is this under some sort of Creative Commons license or a freely usable license?
It's a Creative Commons license for free non-commercial use or non-public commercial use.
What's the difference?
Well, so if you were, we've got, let's say you're at a bank and you want to pull in this open source data and use it internally, that's perfectly permissible. What we're asking is that you don't use the data to generate revenue, commercial, outward-facing presentation.
Okay, but like could say the Git project use this to help promote themselves better. Look how busy we are on
Yes, absolutely.
That. Okay.
Absolutely. We would love for them to do that. In any way we could help in that, we'd be delighted to do so.
And what are the more unusual ways you've seen this data be used?
I think...
Tough question, I know.
I think the most unusual use of our data, of which I have heard, we have a lot of people using our API to collect our data, and we don't know what they do with it. We're not very nosy about it. We do have a lot of academic research that we support. We open up the API limits to allow researchers larger volumes, larger throughputs. I think, but the most interesting use was a company that was trying to identify open source contributors in their competitors' companies so they could identify the technologies in which their competitors were investing.
Ooh.
That, I thought, was pretty clever.
Now, obviously, you have this really cool website written in Ruby on Rails.
Yeah,
but is there an API for this? Can I have an automated query of this?
Yes, there is. There's the Yolo API, and by default, will allow you to create 10 keys, and each key can make 1,000 requests a day. And take our data. Please take our data.
Can I pull it out in a JSONP or something like that?
It's XML.
Okay.
We have plans on the next revision of the API to produce JSONP.
That would be really cool because I know there's so many of these now smart apps, and it would be great to have like a little dashboard somewhere on there that said that my project was, you know, at this stage in the hub.
That's right. So the work that we've been doing, if I may,
yeah,
talk about that.
Let's talk about
plan.
Yes.
So the Open Hub is just over 10 years old now. It started as Olo in '06, and a few years ago, about two years ago, we recognized we had a fair amount of technical debt. We were still running an old version of Ruby on Rails, and it was starting to be sunsetted. We weren't getting security updates. And we knew that we had to break some eggs. We had some omelets we wanted to make, and we had to push things forward. And so 2 years ago, we rewrote our user interface, the entire front end, the latest version of Ruby on Rails, much more performant, much more maintainable. We're able to introduce new features. Shortly after that, and a lot of this information I've put up on our blog, blog.openhub.net. I try to be really open because we're a free product. I try to be really open and transparent with the open source community. So in 2016, we had a catastrophic failure of some of our back-end systems. At that time, we were running 18 servers that would pull down the repositories and spread them across redundant RAID arrays. And we lost one of those. And it was a real obvious lesson that we had to have a more reliable infrastructure. And so we started to virtualize that whole back-end infrastructure. And that became the second code base, the FizzBot code base. And recently we were able to expand that, so we're now able to provide that service to the entire Black Duck organization. So that FizzBot infrastructure has grown and is now serving all of Black Duck, both the Open Hub and the knowledge base, which feeds our primary commercial product. Well, it's one of the channels. And our next body of work is going to be to rewrite our Olo analytics engine and strip out all of that old code we no longer need. Just last weekend, we deployed a major architectural upgrade. This entire application, all of our users and all of our analytics and all of our import was all being run on a single monolithic database. It was the first note I took the first day out of the job at Black Duck. I said, we've got to split the databases. Well, it took time, but we did a really excellent job, and we got the support from the organization. Now, remember, we're not a revenue generator, so we have to justify our existence every single day.
Mm-hmm.
And we got permission to do it, and we got support and the hardware to do it right, and we just deployed that. So our back-end system, our FizzBot, now has its own separate database and its own standalone application. And then the Olo stack, which is analysis and the UI, that now runs on its own database. The two of them are strongly connected with Postgres's foreign data wrapper.
Oh, yeah.
But we're going to be starting to peel those apart and make the FizzBot a standalone service accessible through its API, publishing events out to RabbitMQ. Oh, another open source product.
Yes.
We use.
Nice.
So we're really excited about this because our plan is first, to restore the back end so that all 600,000 code locations are checked every 24 to 72 hours, as has been our standing commitment. And then to make our website so much more performant so that we're really able to deliver pages and updates and API requests much faster than we are today, about a third of the time that we're doing it today. That's our goal, and we'd like to have that done within the next couple of months.
Great, great. I have to ask, are you hiring and what kinds of people?
Black Duck is hiring.
But I mean, is your team hiring?
My team just added another engineer, our 10th. We have our full complement of staff.
Cool.
Yeah, we're very happy.
Cool. And also, as I was thinking about this, you know, obviously projects and Git repositories and various source code repositories are a big thing. But you know, at today's talks here at OSCON, it's all about containers, at least on the track that I'm on and want to attend. Are you going to start tracking, say, Docker forks, Docker things? Or is that all sort of built in because those are just Git repositories anyway?
Well, we have that as Git repositories. We do track that. There are a couple other things. There are we would like our commercial product is able to scan into containers and identify container structure there. I'd like to be able to add a similar thing to the Open Hub because we've got a lot of public repositories. We can go to Docker Open public Docker repositories, and we can scan there, and we can connect those Docker repositories to the open source software that they use and allow people to understand, hey, if I'm going and I'm downloading this container, what am I going to get?
Yeah.
Well, if you can find that on the Open Hub, and you can see the open source projects that feed into that, and you can see all of the metrics, their activity indicator, their most recent commits, any vulnerabilities known within that, you can get a good idea of what you're getting in that container. So that's future functionality in which we're very interested in building.
Well, and I think also you could look at that from the other perspective, which is I don't know if my open source project is being used by containers because it's not obvious unless you do some sort of crawling of that. So I'd like to know every place that I'm used as well as everything that I use.
Great point. Yes, you should be able to see it both ways. Similarly, one of the things that our commercial product does is builds a bill of materials so you know all of the open source components and their versions in your repository, in your source. We'd like to provide that for the open source community as well. And again, it's two-way navigation, so you can see this open source project is used in these, and it is in turn composed of those.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the kind of things that we're confident we'll be able to build as we stabilize our existing infrastructure from this new deployment.
You know, it sounds like that'd be a great thing to use as raw data for a huge visualization to show people when they say, well, open source is just a bunch of people creating stuff in their spare time, right? No, it's actually, we have this whole continuum of all the projects, everything is built on top of. So it'd be nice to have a good visualization of the top 500 open source projects and all the links that lead down and forward from them.
Yeah, all of that web of interconnections. I'd like to see that for the community as well. It's really hard to visualize how a community changes over time.
Mm.
And we've done a lot of research over the past few years in looking at the data that we have and trying to map that and look at specifically the community. How do we visually represent how a community changes? Who is interacting with whom and who's resolving issues, who's reporting issues, who's on the technical side, who's on the managerial side? How does the structure of the open source project community change over time? So that's also an area of research in which we've invested and are trying to make available as well.
You know, that's the question that just came up. It's like maybe you don't want to hire any more people, but are you looking for people's skill sets, like, say, DataViz and things like that? And is this an open source project? Can people see the source to this and contribute to it?
Well, that's... I am so pleased that you brought that up because at the very end of my presentation on Thursday here at OSCON, I'm going to switch and go live, and we're going to open source another aspect of the Olo stack. We're going to open source the Olo UI and put it out there. We're hoping that the open source community can help us internationalize the application, can help us with our layout issues because we focused on presentation for desktop and laptop, and it doesn't look so good on mobile. And also to put it out there so people can see the data structures underneath, and it can help us with things like creating new visualizations for the application.
Well, we're almost out of time, but I do want to get to two more areas that you nudged me about in our previous conversations.
Yeah.
How dance? You went from dance to being in software?
Yes. When I was a young man, I was a ballet dancer, and my friends would say, Peter, what would you like to do this weekend? I'll say, let's go out and pick up some girls, you know, like
physically. Yeah.
It was a wonderful thing to do. It discipline and physical shape, and those were really, really important. From dance, I got into choreography. I choreographed for a while. I got interested in the technical side, the design. I ended up going to graduate school for lighting design. I have a master's of fine arts in lighting design.
Mm-hmm.
I worked up and down throughout New England, down into New York City, off Broadway, really exciting stuff. And as the tale goes, as it happens, I met a pretty lady, and I decided I had to do something else. The theater is a lovely hobby. It's a very challenging career. And I took some courses at Columbia and got a job in a Skunk Works doing development for a set-top box that AT&T was developing at the time, Skunk Works team. The analogy from the theatrical world to the technical world, it's not as far off as one might think. You see, in the theater, everybody knows. There's an opening night. The audience is going to come in, the curtain's going to go up, and by gum, you better be ready. If we had that attitude in software,
yeah,
we would be doing things a lot differently. Mm-hmm. If we maintained our commitments, and this is part and parcel of the presentation that I'm giving on Thursday, there's no reason why we can't deliver outstanding software on time and exceed the expectations of our key stakeholders. And that's something that I really got out of the theater world, is that you have to be flexible about what you're producing so that what you do produce is on time, it's the right thing. It's more valuable to have something small and good and right that's available to use right now than to have something you think about maybe having some ways off. And I think that definitely came out of the experience that I had as a performer.
Cool. That's a good, amazing analogy. One of the things I've learned is that whenever I learn skills, it applies to all the areas that I participate in. I mean, I started out as a programmer, but then I became a writer and a teacher and now a podcaster. You know, but all the skills kept applying over and over again.
That's right. Yeah, and they just kind of opened up new doors for you as you continue to explore them, which probably is your next question about the next new door.
I'm looking at here, and I see the word Mars. Well, tell me about Mars.
Mars is a lovely planet that I would like to call my home someday. In 2011, I came across a program out of the Netherlands called Mars One. It's a not-for-profit foundation, and the founder, Bas Lansdorp, had a vision of creating a permanent human colony on Mars. And ever since I was a little boy, I wanted to go into space. If there was ever a possibility to live on another planet, I knew I would take it. My wife and I had that exact conversation before we were married. Would you be willing to be a colonist on another planet? She said no. I said yes. So when this opportunity came along, I signed up for it, and I told her, honey, I'm going to Mars. Bye-bye. But she's been incredibly supportive as the rounds have gone on. Over 200,000 people started the application. And now in round three, there are 100 of us, 50 men, 50 women. And so when I got into round three, my wife was exuberant and very supportive. The reality has set in that if I do get selected and I become one of the six teams of four people to begin 10 or 15 years of training with a chance of going to Mars and spending my life there, that I would have to leave my wife and I'd have to leave our five children, whatever grandchildren we have at that point. Family, friends, siblings, all of that. This is an opportunity unlike any other.
Sure.
And it's one about which I feel incredibly strong and very focused and determined. I want to go live on another planet. The part of the Mars One program that really appealed to me was its focus on finding the right people who can come together as a high-performing team. That's what I've been doing for over 15 years in my career.
And yes.
It's like, I know this is the right way to approach solving these kinds of problems. And so I had to pitch in. I believe in the mission. I believe in the way they're structuring it and setting it up. And I think I'm one of the few people on Earth who could go and be part of a small team in this uncertain environment and really thrive there, establishing a permanent beachhead for humanity to expand our human civilization.
That is awesome. I can honestly say we haven't had anybody else on this show ever. I mean, we've talked to the Mars rover drivers, but they don't mind doing it remotely. I mean, they're not the same thing that you would be doing.
I'm going to go.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, cool. Hey, we're almost out of time. Is there anything we didn't cover about what we were going to talk about today that you think we still need to make sure gets said?
I don't think. I think we've been really thorough. Is there anything that we mentioned?
I'm not sure there's anything we missed.
I don't think there's anything we missed.
Okay.
I would like to just reiterate that as the Open Hub really only succeeds when we have support from the open source community. And we're a small team. There's a lot that we do in maintaining all of these open source projects. But if we're not able to understand what our community needs and respond to that, then we don't have any reason to exist. And so if there's anything that I can do, anything that I can hear or learn that is needed, I ask people to please contact us at info@openhub.net. It's on our blog. It's on our site. Let us know. Come share your thoughts. And we'll do everything that we can to make the Open Hub the best resource for the open source community.
And two final questions. That's awesome. Two final questions, or else my audience will kill me. What is the text editor that you spend all day in, and what is your favorite programming language?
Well, I use Vim.
Okay.
I didn't ask for your approval, my friend.
I know. Yes.
Right? I had been Emacs in the early days. And,
okay.
I use Vim currently, and I love working in Ruby. I came up from C, C++. I used to teach those languages. I taught Java. I love spending my days working in Ruby.
I kind of figured that was going to be the answer there. Hey, I just want to say it's been great having you on today. I'm glad you can make some time in your busy OSCON schedule to come up and hang out with me for an hour so that we could get this all down. And now I appreciate you making sort of you're previewing your announcement you're going to make Thursday. Are you just actually going to push the button Thursday?
Says I'm going to go live and do it right there in front of everybody in the room.
Wow, cool. So if you're sitting at home and you still get the OSCON feed, I think people can still get real-time feeds if they're signed up but they're not here. But maybe they'll see that, yeah. But anyway, thank you for being on today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
That was Peter Degenportnoy talking to us about Open Hub. And normally I would turn to my co-host at this point and say, well, what did you think? And that would give me time to prepare to scroll down my list of things I'm going to say. You thought there wasn't any reason for me to do that every time, right? But it's really so I can just position my little scroll here. And here I am. Because we're going to talk about the upcoming guests. Well, what I think before we get moving on, which is usually my half at the end of the show, is that this was amazing. This is cool. And go play with this stuff. I was fascinated by all the things I saw on there, and I forgot to ask him why Dartlang says it's written in JavaScript. That was pretty weird, because Dartlang is written in Dart, not JavaScript. It converts to JavaScript. So there's probably a lot of that in there as well. Okay, so let's look at who's coming up. Next week, we do have Kubernetes update. We last talked to them in 2015. I'm actually here studying a whole bunch of stuff about Docker and Kubernetes and all that stuff, all the stuff containers, because I'm going to be writing a short course for ZipRecruiter so I can talk more about Docker and actually just also be smarter about Docker. That seems to be the way everything's going these days. Following that, we've got the Node.js Package Manager, also known as NPM, Faraday RF, which is a digital radio networking using the 33-centimeter band. It's an amateur band, but they're overlaying this nice coordinated digital layers over the top. We've got Magento after that. It's a commerce platform. It's basically shopping carts on steroids. We've got Cockpit, which is, as far as I can tell, similar to Webmin. It's to administer your Linux system via the web, which should be pretty cool. Brian Bellendorf is going to talk to us about Hyperledger, which is a blockchain technology like Bitcoin and everything like that. And that's coming from the Linux Foundation, though, so they're going to try to centralize all of that stuff. If you want to find out about all these and more, go to the homepage for this show, twit.tv/floss. From there, you'll find a link to the giant spreadsheet, as we like to call it, of all the current and upcoming guests and potential guests. And if you see a project on that list, no, set it backwards again. If you have a project that you want on this show and it's not on that list, have the project leader or community coordinator email me, merlin@stoneedge.com. My address is also there on that page. We still have a few slots left in Q2, but we do have opened up early parts of Q3. We've always got open slots. You can always make more. There's always room for Jell-O. We have a live stream at 9:30 a.m. Pacific time. It still is, Tuesdays at live.twit.tv. You can watch us behind the scenes, see how we're actually doing the show. A few people asked questions in today's chat room, but since I didn't have a co-host to hand off to, it was really tough to kind of keep watching the chat room and also talk to my guest and not lose track of what they're saying. That will actually shift, though, to Wednesdays beginning June 28th. We are moving permanently from Tuesday to Wednesday starting June 28th because the Twit Network wanted the Tuesday morning slot for something else, and that's perfectly okay. They publish my show. I'm I'm very happy with that. Okay, you can follow us at Floss Weekly on Google Plus and at Floss Weekly on Twitter. You can follow me at Randall L. Schwartz on Google Plus and at Merlin on Twitter, M-E-R-L-Y-N. I'm here at OSCON this week. If you're watching this show live, come up and say hi to me. Actually, it was kind of fun because in the first talk of the day, somebody said in the room, the host that was in the room said, I was watching the Floss Weekly show a couple years ago, and they mentioned Crate.db or Crate.io, Crate.io, and I selected that. So I immediately raised my hands and went, oh, hey, Randall, you're in the audience. That's so great. I got to come up and shake your hand. That was so awesomely cool to be recognized like that, that it actually changed the whole nature of their business because they watched something on this show, which I was really, really happy about. Let me keep going here. I'm going to be at YAPSE in a few weeks. That's the Perl Conference. Actually, it's called the Perl Conference now. DragonCon coming up in September, talking about Dart again. Allthingsopen.org over the research triangle. I think that's in October or something like that. But again, I would normally turn to my co-host at this point and offer them a chance to plug everything they have. But since there's none of those, it's just up to me. I did it all by myself. Well, plus the guest. Okay. Anyway, we'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.